surf season is now in full swing around Hawaii. Professional competitions are underway on two islands this week. Maui is hosting two, a big wave event at Peahi and the last competition of the women's professional season at Honolulu Bay. On Oahu's North Shore, the second event of the annual Triple Crown of Surfing is underway at Sunset Beach. All three events were organized by the World Surf League, professional surfing's governing body. Now, pulling together those kinds of events is no easy feat. HPR's Ryan Finnerty takes us to Sunset Beach for an inside look at the business of surfing.
Surfing may be the ancestral sport of Hawaii, but these days it's also big business. The global surfing industry is worth about $10 billion per year. At the forefront of that industry is the World Surf League. Every year, the WSL runs more than 180 events at all levels of competition. In 2018, more than 2,400 male and female competitors caught waves in 27 countries around the world. The last stop on that world tour is right here in Hawaii. Every year, a three-part series known as the Triple Crown of Surfing is held on the North Shore of Oahu. At Haleiwa and Sunset Beach, athletes compete for scarce spots on the World Championship Tour. At Pipeline, the world's best surfers battle for the title of world champion.
The Vans Triple Crown is a series of three premier events that round out the World Surf League season annually.
That's Jody Wilmot, the World Surf League's general manager for Hawaii and Tahiti Nui. One of her many jobs is to make sure that the Triple Crown gets off the ground and in the water every year. I sat down with her as crews were setting up at Sunset Beach for the second leg of the three-part event.
We're in our 36th year of the Vans Triple Crown series, but some of the individual events of that series have actually been going for a lot longer. For example, the Billabong Pipe Masters is in its 48th year. And this is the last stop on the world tour where athletes have a chance to qualify for that elite championship tour level of 2019, and where for the elite championship tour surfers of 2018, the showdown for the world title.
And so what goes into putting it all on? These are three pretty big events, all on the North Shore. How many people are involved in putting this all together?
Definitely around the range of about 250 people from A to Z. All those facets of catering, security, broadcast is a big one. We can have up to 75 people involved with just broadcasting this live around the world. Construction crews of up to 30 people. A lot of different people coming into it, Hawaiian Water Patrol that do the jet ski rescues, and then on top of that, all up about 160 surfers. So a lot of people involved, a lot of facets of the production, and a lot of cooperation all around.
And how far in advance do you need to start planning for, let's say, next year's events?
It's a minimum of a year. Fortunately, the city and county have adopted a multi-year permit application process, which allows us to then hopefully plan a little further out. You can imagine with global events and multi-year deals with sponsors and those sorts of logistics, you're trying to secure the future of the event for both athletes and the business side of it as far in advance as you can. But in terms of actually constructing the events, it would be a year. And that's where we're looking at all of the submissions of site plans and coordination, taking a look at beach profiles and seeing what's the best we can do for the environment in staging an event. For example, here at Sunset Beach, you'll see we're completely roadside. And all of those logistics you just have to be very flexible with and make a lot of changes and adaptations along the way and get ready for game day.
And you mentioned that multi-year permit process that the city and county of Honolulu has adopted, and that was kind of in response to some requests to change it by the World Surf League. One of the reasons that the WSL was interested in changing that was, as I understand it, you were considering or wanted to move the Pipe Masters event from the end of the tour, where it's currently the last stop, as you mentioned earlier, to the beginning of the tour. And what was the thinking behind that?
A lot of that hinged upon providing the athletes with a seasonal break. Most professional league sports, the athletes will have a four-month or more off-season. Professional surfers are really battling it out all year round. It's a 12-month season with very little break before they have to start again. And we're just starting to see quite a number of athletes getting serious injuries. And once you're out for 1 year, there's only so many injury wildcards we can offer. And there are people that literally can drop out completely, like a Dusty Payne from Maui, for example. And they just don't have time to recover from pretty serious injury. So we were trying to create a buffer between, you know, 1 year's tour and the start of the next, and also pick the best season. And pretty much everyone around here would tell you that the optimal time for Pipeline is around, you know, late January through February. We see the Vulcan Pipe Pro in that period, and it always scores exceptional waves. So it was a combination of those factors. It didn't play out. It wasn't possible for us to switch our permits with ourselves. And that's just the way it came about. And we've applied for the next 3 years under the multi-year permit application process to continue to hold Pipeline and the Triple Crown exactly where it is. So for anyone who keeps asking what's happening with the Pipe Masters, it's on and it's in the same spot.
You mentioned that certain times of the year have better waves than others in certain spots, and the World Tour is a world tour. How do you go about deciding exactly when to hold an event in any particular place? You know, what set of weeks? Because you are very much at the whim of Mother Nature.
Yeah, thankfully, there's a lot of great forecasting tools and organizations out there right now. We do look at a lot of historic data. And even within a one-month time frame, for example, the event that we have in Keramas in Indonesia this year, we're looking at that for next year. And you made a tweak of a few days just to get it into what is historically a better series of days to hold the event. So we do look very closely, and that's the job of the commissioners in our sport, to really analyze the breaks, talk to the people that have the history at those locations, look at any historical data and records that are available, and make the call accordingly. We want to give surfers the best window of opportunity everywhere we go.
We're sitting on some newly restored dunes at Sunset Beach, which experienced really record-setting erosion this past winter. And that sort of gets into the idea that the planet is changing, that historical data maybe isn't going to reflect what's happening in the future. Is that something that the WSL explores when setting contest dates and locations?
Absolutely. We take a multi-year approach to that, particularly at a venue like Sunset Beach. And it was about 3 years ago that I started to see that really scary type of erosion that was going on out here, where we're getting down to kind of bedrock in the shore break. And I thought, you know, these episodes of intense storms and wave systems are going to be increasing due to the global warming. And so we should be planning with that in mind, that the beach is going to be reduced seasonally, and start to adapt our and modify our plans for what we do here. So in fact, over the past 3 years, we've gradually receded from the sand itself. This year, when you come down to the Vans World Cup at Sunset Beach, you'll see one camera tower up near the lifeguard tower, and another one off behind me, one on the point. And that's going to be about the only thing you'll see on the beach. Everything else is roadside, and it's a challenging setup for sure. And even our stage, our award stage for this year's event, is going to be across the road in the park. So we continue to modify. You know, it's in everyone's best interest that resources like shorelines are managed and everybody gets to enjoy it, and we take care of it as much as we can. So the rejuvenation project with the dune here, we invested a lot of time and money into that and worked with the community to try to keep what we've got left.
Pro surfing's a pretty young sport, relatively speaking. Where do you see it going in the next 5-10 years?
It's an interesting question. I think the nature of what we do is so pure as a surfer. It's really your interaction with nature that is the fundamental connection and the inspiration of it all. And I think that's never going to change. I know we've got, you know, the wave systems like the Kelly Slater Wave Company that are in action, and a lot of new wave technology emerging around the world. So for sure, that's going to become a component of it. But I think the relationship between man, woman, and ocean will always be central to a surfer's lifestyle, and central in 24 hours a day. It's what we think about, wake up, and dream about as well. And nothing's going to erase that. It will always be a pretty pure pursuit, And then there are those who are motivated to see if they're the best in the world, and the sport will continue to be there.
You mentioned man, woman, and ocean, and I think that's kind of significant because the WSL just not too long ago announced that it would pay equal prize money to male and female athletes. And I wonder if you could just tell us what kind of feedback you've gotten on that decision. And then maybe, is there a chance that we'll see men and women competing against each other at any time in the future?
Very proud of the World Surf League, and many people have, you know, chimed in and shared their excitement about the announcement of the equality there. It's great to see the women in that situation now, and they're in the best position they've ever been in to compete professionally and to have a life in surfing that they should be rewarded with and rewarded for. As far as men and women competing together, my personal opinion is that with wave technology in the, let's call it a wave system, in those inland pools or whatever. It's interesting, in watching the women compete there at the Surf Ranch earlier this year, the technology behind those waves really generates a lot of the power. The athlete themselves don't have to generate the power. And my personal opinion was that it leveled the field between men and women considerably. And we saw a number of women like Carissa Moore just powerhouses on that platform. And so I think the wave pools might be an area where you see men and women very fairly up against each other. It seems to be a great equalizer because the wave provides the power for you. There's not that physiological difference accentuated so much as it is in the ocean, where you often have to generate and control a lot of the power yourself. And I think we're going to see that happen. I mean, women are not going to become men, and men are not going to become women. And so I think everybody's pretty understanding of the fact that there are physiological differences, but the level of performance is not limited. So it's going to be a pretty exciting future.
Surfing's really expanding around the world beyond Western nations into a lot of lesser developed countries, and it's almost providing a means for those communities and individuals within those communities to advance themselves. How do you view surfing through that lens, and maybe what role, if any, the World Surf League has in that process?
Yeah, I think it's a responsibility of ours to be part of that. And I know that many of our regional offices spend a great deal of time becoming invested in their own communities and operations outside of just running events. We probably spend 70% of our time here in Hawaii producing and planning events, and 30%, if not more, out there in schools and in community programs and doing work with community partners. And it's just so rewarding to see what can come of those types of relationships when you're working with school groups on career opportunity in and out of the water. And just this past weekend, I've watched a great movie by the Gadowskis brothers and Michael February, a surfer out of South Africa. And it was a fantastic film about them bringing about 700 surfboards donated from around the world into the Cape Town area in South Africa. And they have actually got a program over there, a weekly program, where they pick young kids up from the townships and bring them out to the beach. And it's become a very spiritual and psychologically healing time for these kids to experience this unique environment of the ocean, and to completely escape a lot of the stressors and conflicts and trauma that they have in some of those townships. So on a global scale, that's what surfing offers more than anything. Competition's just one aspect of it. But it is that spiritual relationship with something far greater than yourself, which makes it somewhat of a religion, perhaps, that keeps us all so tapped into it and wanting to surf again. And that's ultimately what World Surf League contributes to. It uses a platform of competition, which is a great stage for reaching people, but the real essence of it goes beyond a timed heat and a result. It's about that relationship, and it's about elevating a life experience.
All right, Jody Wilmot, thanks so much for your time today.
Great to talk to you. Thanks.
We've been talking with Jody Wilmot, the World Surf League's general manager for Hawaii and Tahiti Nui. Professional competitions are underway on Maui and Oahu this week. The waiting period for the Pipe Masters begins on December 8th. You can follow all the action at worldsurfleague.com.